time I've been at UC Santa Barbara, and I am moving here. It is so beautiful. I bet the weather's like this every day, right? Every day, unbelievable. What a spectacular place. Students all look so happy, except for the ones who are protesting, but they looked happy too. Great, so you guys made it. You're not in your protests, or you're going to go back to the protests later. Anyway, how many of you are students, just to kind of get a sense? Okay, fabulous. And how many are faculty? Faculty, staff kind of people, great. And what's the rest? Community members? A few community members? Okay, is there any group I'm missing? Okay. Unemployed, he's unemployed. Okay, maybe by the end, maybe someone will hire you. Okay, if you're, okay. Maybe you'll come up with an idea for a new venture. Okay, so first of all, I want to say I have been incredibly impressed. I have had a very full day already, and every single one of my needs have been met. Even when I said, you know, I really need a piece of chocolate, all of a sudden three doors open and everybody handed me a different chocolate bar. So I have been very, very well taken care of here, and I hope that you are find this interesting. I also, how many of you have taken entrepreneurship-related classes on campus here? Great. So I'm hoping that you will chime in with things that that you've done that maybe parallel some of the things I'm talking about, because I know the program. I've known Gary Hansen, Professor Hansen, for many, many years, and I am one of his biggest fans, and I have watched this program evolve over the years, and it's really impressive. So let's get going. The first question I always like to ask, and we were talking today about asking questions, which is sort of the way to learn things. The question I always ask is, what is entrepreneurship? Now, you guys have all taken classes, so this should be a really, really easy question. So, what is entrepreneurship? I want to make sure we're on the same page here, because if I'm talking about entrepreneurship and you're thinking of something else, so don't all jump in at once. Okay, something really simple. What's the simplest thing? What's an entrepreneur? What's an entrepreneur? Someone who takes risks. What else? What's that?
Tries to make money.
Tries to make money. Takes risks, tries to make money.
Turns an idea into a business.
Starts with an idea and turns it into something that's a business. Perfect?
Thinks big.
Big ideas. Okay?
Adds value.
Creates value. What?
Multidisciplinary.
Lots of skills. Great. The definition I like to use is that and it fits into all of these things that you said. So, but this is the definition we're going to use in this talk. Is that entrepreneurship is about seizing opportunities, identifying opportunities, and creating value without regard for the resources that you currently control. So it means, I've got a great idea, we're going to go do something, this is the big idea part of it, is that we're going to do it, I'm not going to be limited by the fact that I only have, I actually only have $1 in my pocket. I didn't do that on purpose. I just did have $1 in my pocket. But, you know, that I only have $1 in my pocket, I'm not going to use that as a limiting force, because that ends up really framing what you can do if you start out looking at what the limited resources you currently have. So do you guys buy that definition? Is that something we can live with? Okay. So what we do, and the way that I like to view this, is that we don't think in our program that you just learn entrepreneurship for the sake of entrepreneurship. It's basically about layering it on top of other things, some other deep knowledge. Have you ever seen something like this? Have you ever heard of T-shaped people? Have you ever heard about this? Okay, I love this. And I learned this from my colleagues over the Design Institute at Stanford. The idea that you're looking often to hire T-shaped people. These are people with a depth of knowledge in some discipline, but a breadth of knowledge about other things. So I'm assuming, because I know the program here also is like this, in that everybody has a different major. Nobody is coming and getting a degree in entrepreneurship, right? We've got chemical engineers, we've got neuroscientists, we have a mechanical engineering, see, I remembered. Okay, we have all of these different disciplines, but layering on top of it these skills to really be a leader. And the skills that go across the top are things that I put into two categories. There's the business skills, the things like that you would typically learn at business school, strategy, marketing, finance. But there's also the leadership skills, negotiation, teamwork, creativity. And those things together create this breadth of knowledge about business and leadership that allow you to take the ideas you come up with and turn them into real ventures. Okay, because if I'm just a neuroscientist in my lab, and that's actually my background is in neuroscience. If I'm a neuroscientist, I come up with something. If I don't have those other skills, I really can't take it to the next level. So do you guys buy this? Okay. So how do you teach entrepreneurship? How do you teach this? I mean, these are things that, some of these things are kind of tough to teach in a classroom setting. They certainly, you know, people sitting in rows and columns, it's difficult to teach everybody about these skills. So I strongly believe, and in fact, you will hopefully feel by the end of this talk that you kind of feel like you've been in my classroom, that entrepreneurship is a contact sport. You have to get in the game. You need to go and do it, because it's something you learn here, oops, and here. You learn it in your gut. You learn it in your heart. You don't always learn it in your head. Because you can get up and people will tell you war stories. People will tell you what happens. But when you get in the situation, you stay, oh my gosh, now what do I do? Because every situation is different. So I'm going to tell you three stories. Oh, first of all, before I start with three stories, I want to ask you. Now, I sort of have a sample here of people who are taking either teaching or taking classes in entrepreneurship. But before we start, I want to know, how many of you think that entrepreneurship and innovation can be taught? How many people really think? I mean, you ask yourself deep down, how many think it really can be taught? One, two, three, it looks like maybe 20% of you. I'm going to ask you again at the end, all right? And we'll see if we got any different answer, all right? So I'm going to tell you three stories. You guys ready? All right. The first story is actually an action one. I want each of you, you know what, I don't remember, how much time do we have? As long as I want? Okay. Because this one, I want to do something. I want each of you to take out your wallets and pass them. No. See, this is how I leverage all the resources in the room. Okay, I want everybody to take out your wallet. Do you have a wallet? Okay. Everyone have a wallet? If you have a wallet, take your wallet. I want you to turn to the person next to you or someone. If it's three people, that's fine. But turn to the person next to you. Okay? And I want you to just take 2 minutes, one minute each, and interview each other about your wallet. The things you love about your wallet and the things you hate about your wallet. Okay? The things that drive you crazy. And I want you to focus on storing things and buying things. How do you store things in it? How would you buy things using things in your wallet? Just 1 minute each, interviewing just a few bullet points about what you love about your wallet, what you hate about your wallet. Okay? Ready? Go.
Probably don't like to be behind the podium, but the lighting is set for the podium, so it's really dark on camera.
Okay, so you want me to stand there?
Yeah.
Perfect. I'll do that. Good.
You.
No problem. Did you bring a wallet?
I have. Not really.
Okay.
Each of us, a sample set who hasn't bought their wallets.
You don't have. You didn't bring them.
I left mine in my car.
Really? Okay.
Mine isn't at work.
Interesting. Okay. Well.
So,
okay.
Glad we sat next
interesting.
To
yeah.
Hi. We stand in front of the podium.
I was already told that.
Okay.
I'll do that. I'm not
awesome.
A big podium. Did any of you bring your wallets? Was it? Oh, you didn't. See, this is a really interesting. Listen, we should have picked shoes because everyone has shoes on. Okay. That's close enough. Okay, but you can talk about what you like. I mean, you probably remember what you like and don't like about your wallet. Okay, everyone. I was told I'm supposed to stand behind the podium because the lighting is better. So I'm gonna. It's not. I'm not typically a podium kind of person, but I guess I was told to follow directions. Anyway, I would love to know what you learned, just really quickly. Shout out things that you learned about someone else's wallet that they really hated about their wallet. Yeah.
It's good that's big and it's bad that's big.
Oh, so it's good it's big because it fits stuff, a lot of stuff, and it's bad it's big because it's probably a pain to carry around. Okay, what else?
Hers is organized and it's better quality.
Than yours. It's very organized, better quality. What does she not like about her wallet?
Doesn't fit a passport.
Doesn't? Yeah, that would be nice. Doesn't fit a passport. What else?
It shows wear, it shows dirt.
Okay, so it gets dirty and, okay. What else? Right, you sit there fumbling, getting coins. And when they give you change back, you know, you've got the dollars and the change, and what do you do with both and the receipt? Yep, what else? Yep.
You wish it had money in it.
That would be good. Wouldn't it be come if they came pre-filled with $100 bills? That would be a great idea. I think we could market that. Okay, anything else? Well, I have done this exercise with everything from groups of 10 people to 500 people. And if I had more time with you and in a classroom setting, what I would do is let you interview each other for much, much longer. You'd come up with all different ideas about things that worked and didn't work, about security issues and storage issues and all sorts of other fantasy features. If you were going to design a wallet and you had no limits at all, if you think really, really big, what would your fantasies for a wallet be? And then what I would have you do in the classroom is have you build them and do really quick prototypes. You would build the wallets for each other, and then what you would do is you would market it and sell it to your customer. Okay, so let me show you a quick, this is a 5-minute video, actually it might be 7 minutes, but I just finished it and I think you'll like it. It's from my class. I did not, it was not designed for me to be shooting the video, so it's really, you'll see. We cut it out of a 2-hour class down to 7 minutes, but to show you how this works in a classroom setting, okay? So let's see if this works. See, it's gonna work. Let's, there we go. So I want each of you to take out your wallet. You are going to spend the next 15 minutes interviewing each other about your wallets, okay? And you're going to find out what the other person, and you're going to talk to each other about this, but take turns, one interview the other and then switch. What you love about your wallet or what you hate about your wallet, okay? And I want you to focus on two things specifically. Things, how you buy things with the wallet and how you store things with the wallet. Okay, ready, set, go.
I like the size. I like that it's sort of compact. It's pretty minimal in terms of not having too many pockets and random things. I can just put everything in one pocket. It'd be nice if it closed a little better.
Okay.
So this is fine, but and it, stuff doesn't fall out, but like, you know, if it does happen to do this, or if I make this pocket a little more empty, sometimes it, stuff is a little more loose in here that easily falls out.
Sure. I have a longer wallet because I like to put my checkbook in the wallet. I've had this wallet for a few years now, so, you know, it's pretty functional, but again, it's just there's a lot of space in here, and I just stuff receipts in here, stuff all my credit cards, and it's just really easy. There's a coin purse in the back. Very straightforward.
So how do you like store things in it? Do you like classify it by dollar amount? Okay, I see. That answers my question.
I like the, it's like higher quality leather that like will last for a while.
I've tried like a clip before.
Ah, yes, right. Money clip.
Yeah, money clip. I don't know, you can chain.
Not practical.
Yeah, it's not so bad. Part of it's practical, part of it is.
And then what you're going to do, just to give you a heads up, is you're going to show it to your customer in a minute and get their feedback on it.
Like, is this like a the storage should be like a ladder structure?
One for card storage, like that, similar to your suggestion with the levels. Exactly, the other one in the middle with some Velcro for coins, so it would be secured and the coins would be able to stay put.
Thank you.
Receipt. You don't need proof of payment.
He likes almost everything about his wallet, except the color inside. and there is one functional factor that Nick didn't quite enjoy. He keeps a lot of cards on one side of his wallet, and he has to cram extras in so because they'll fall out. So we came up with a simple design fix. First off, black. Black inside of his wallet was very important. And then just a simple magnet flap with a clear, thin plastic that would snap over the side where he would keep his extra cards, keep them from falling out.
Basically, it's just a larger wallet because she has a lot of things, and she loves photos, so I have a photo board and just the regular pockets. In the back, we have a coin purse that lifts up, and she wanted somewhere to organize her life, so it's a hardback, and she has a notepad and maybe a checkbook here.
So I had the snap-off pocket for days when she's not going to Blockbuster. She doesn't need that Blockbuster card. She doesn't need the Safeway card, you know, all those things. So she can leave those cards in the detachable pocket and leave that at home. But if it's, you know, a day when she is going to, you know, be needing all those cards, then she can just stick it back onto the wallet and, you know, be happy.
Okay, so this was an example of something where the students, well, we can actually go to the next slide, did a tremendous amount. In 2 hours, they got the whole... Oh, they want me to stand here. Okay. I'm not good at following directions. They got, in a very short period of time, got the whole experience of understanding that problems are everywhere, that they probably were sitting on problems, right? As the wallets were sitting in their pocket, we could have picked anything. We could have picked shoes on their feet. We could have picked their backpacks. We could have picked anything. That problems are everywhere. They got to understand their customer's point of view. Oftentimes in entrepreneurship, when someone's starting a venture, they design something for the world looking only at their own needs, but really understanding how to interview their customer to see what the customer's needs were and their point of view. In fact, in many cases, as you saw, they were designing the wallet for someone else. They didn't say, this is what I want. They said, this is what my customer wants. In addition, they did rapid prototyping. Do you think that these students felt terribly wedded to their designs at the end of 2 hours? No, they could have ripped them up and thrown them away and started over again. That's one of the most exciting parts about doing a project like this, is that you have to do rapid prototypes. You build it, you get feedback, you go back and try it again. Because if you get too wedded to your project and your product too early, you put a stake in the ground and you might be going in the wrong direction. So they learned about rapid prototyping. They also learned about storytelling and giving a pitch. And the fact is that they had to now sell this. So in a very short classroom experience, they got to really take advantage of all of these different pieces of entrepreneurship. Okay, let's now go to the next story. Okay, some of you, how many of you, I understand, okay, maybe I stand here. I understand that some of you listen to our Entrepreneurial Thought Leader lecture series. How many of you have ever listened to them? The two people who came up to me. Okay, so two of you are not allowed to answer this question, okay? Because I know that you've listened to this podcast. So here's the deal. In my class, I decided that I would go down to the essence of entrepreneurship, which I said was opportunity recognition or value creation with the goal of leveraging resources, okay? So what I did is I gave every team an envelope with $5 in it. And I told them that they had as much time as they wanted to plan, but as soon as they opened the envelope, they had 2 hours to make as much money as possible. Okay? Now I'm going to give you every single, in one sentence, I'm going to, or two sentences, I'm going to give you the whole rules of the game. The assignment was given on a Wednesday afternoon, and they were given the envelope and the assignment. On Sunday night, they had to give me one PowerPoint slide. They'd deliver one slide, and it had to tell what they had done in pictures, words. On Monday morning, they each gave a three-minute pitch on what they had done to the class. So what do you think? How much money do you think these students could make with $5 in 2 hours? No answers. What do you think? Do you think anyone could have doubled their money?
$1,000.
$1,000. How'd they do that?
Go to Walmart, buy some paint and some stencils, and go through a neighborhood that has bad curbs painted on it. And then, you know, for emergency and fire, you just say, hey, for $10, I'll paint your curb right now.
I love that idea. Great idea. Do you think you can make $1,000 in 2 hours?
Yeah, charge $10-$20 per person.
Perfect. I love that idea. Great. Really, really great idea. Okay, what do other people think? Super. Good, good, good. Well, the thing that's so funny, do you think, though, that, okay, and then what, you probably wouldn't have enough paint with $5, so you might have to go back and buy some more paint?
Spray paint.
Oh, spray paint. So with $5 spray paint, you could do it.
Yeah, I mean, once you hit about 50 people,
you gotta go buy some more paint. But then you'd have money to reinvest in your business and keep doing it. Great. Love that idea. What else? What other things do you think people could do? Lemonade stand, the classic lemonade stand. Great, buy some, go pick some lemons even. Great, all right, I love that idea. What else?
Scratchers.
What's that?
Buy scratchers.
Buy scratchers, gambling, okay? Maybe the first thing, I actually am so impressed with all of you. I'm so impressed. Here's what typically happens when I tell people this story. Typically, people go, well, maybe they could have doubled their money. Maybe they could have made $50, maybe 10 times the amount. Okay, and then when you ask how they did it, they're just, all they want to say is, well, they went to Las Vegas, you know. They went and, you know, arbitrage or something. I love the ideas that you guys have because you're right on track. What the students did was amazing. They initially started out thinking, this is an impossible project. What are we going to do? But then they got their thinking caps on and they'd already been in the class and had been doing a bunch of stuff. So they started thinking bigger and bigger and bigger. The winning team didn't make $1,000. I'm curious whether you really, in 2 hours, you could make $1,000?
I did.
Fabulous. I love that. I'm going to try that. Okay.
It's
next time.
It's
really hard work. Backbreaking, but it's 2 hours.
Sometimes people don't believe what you're saying. But I mean, hey, you got the stuff with you.
And you're going to say, I'm going to paint it for you. Yeah. I love it. Great idea. The winning team made $650. And the average return was $200. And one team lost a dollar. So the thing, there were 14 teams. I know, that was a hard job to lose a dollar. So they get the prize for the biggest failure. In fact, on that note, I love the fact that you mentioned that. One of my favorite assignments I give my students is that they have to write failure resumes. I think you need to do this. Do you do this with your students? Failure resumes. Your biggest screw-ups. Personal, professional, and academic. You can just imagine these Stanford students are really keen on doing that. They've already looked through their life, you know, completely based on all of their successes. And in fact, some of the students have a hard time doing it. You know, the only failure they get is, well, I didn't make it onto that XYZ team and it was the coach's fault, you know. They can't really understand, you know, how do they make it their failure. But failure resumes are a fabulous exercise if you decide to do it yourself, because the fact is, failure is okay as long as you learn something from it. So in the resume, you have to write, I failed that exam, or I didn't get that job, or whatever happened, and what did I learn from it? Because failure is part of the process. In fact, if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you are going to fail a lot. In fact, with our rapid prototyping, hopefully the students learned if their first prototype didn't work, you're going to fail fast and frequently. And you're going to then keep iterating until you get to something that works. So I'm going to tell you some of the stories of some of the things that these students did. Okay, this team was really clever. I love this because of the simplicity of it. In fact, one of the lessons from this project was that the teams that made the most money did not use the $5. They realized the $5 was a limitation, and that essentially there were other assets that they had at their disposal that were worth a lot more than $5. So this team went into the student union on campus, and they set up a bicycle pump and a tire pressure reader. And they basically said they would measure everyone's tire bike tire pressure for free. And if you needed air in your tires, they would charge you a dollar to pump it up. Initially, they thought that they were taking advantage of the students because the students could drive down the street and go to the gas station. But they realized very shortly that people were so appreciative that they were right in the center of campus and that every single student needed air in their tires. And so they realized that they were adding a real value. So they stopped halfway through the 2 hours, stopped asking for a dollar, and they asked for donations. And guess what? They made a lot more. They walked away with several hundred dollars for a couple hours of pumping up tires. Okay, so they made a bunch of money. This one is very clever. Look at that stack of bills there, okay? They realized this students looked around campus and said, guess what? It's parents' weekend. What can we do to leverage these parents on campus? So what they did is they got free maps to Stanford and the surrounding community. They went into town, and they went to all these restaurants. And they said, would you like to buy an ad? This is for parents' weekend. They sold ads for $50 a piece. Okay, and put call-outs on the map for the restaurants with little arrows. And then they went in front of the Alumni Center, and they handed them out for free and asked the parents for donations. And they made a ton of money. Everyone was appreciative. The restaurants were appreciative. The parents were appreciative. And the students were certainly appreciative. You see the picture of the student there explaining it to the parents. Okay, so that was another one. This one is brilliant. These students realized that if you went into town in Palo Alto on Saturday night, the lines for the restaurants are sometimes an hour and a half long. So they basically made reservations at all of these restaurants and scalped them. Okay? So they essentially went and to these restaurants, and in fact, they realized what they learned is it worked best with the restaurants that had the little buzzy things, you know, that you get, because it was actually something tangible you could sell to someone as opposed to, I have a reservation, yeah, right, I believe you. So they also learned that the female students on the team were much better salespeople than the male students, so that the people trusted the women students more. I wonder why. But anyway, so they made a ton of money. And here's what the cool thing is, they could flip them, right? So I bought your time, I gave you my time, I now had your buzzer. So now they could then sell that as that time arrived. So they basically kept flipping it through the evening until they made a bunch of money selling their reservations. Okay? Pretty clever? Okay? No, but why does the restaurant care? I mean, I'm not quite sure that the restaurant, you know, this is a sort of side business. I think they were a little worried about what the restaurants would think, but I think in the long run, I'm not quite sure if I was a restaurant owner, I think it would be fine. So this group said, okay, it is this weekend. You know, there's always 1,000 things going on campus. I'm sure that's true here as well. They realized it was the Viennese Ball. So they went to the Viennese Ball, and they took pictures. This is one of the faculty members. Do you know Terry Winograd? He's kind of a pretty famous computer scientist. And his wife, who's also was on the teaching team, and they went to the Viennese Ball, they took pictures of couples coming in and asked them for donations and sent them digital pictures of them from the party. Okay, and they made out handsomely. I can't remember how much, but they made quite a lot of money because people were very happy to have someone there taking pictures of them in their beautiful finery. So I think the last one, though, is my absolute favorite. This is the team that made $650. They sold their 3-minute pitch time in class to a company that wanted to recruit the students. They realized the most valuable thing they had was not the $5, it was not their time, it was that 3 minutes and 3 PowerPoint slides. And they basically got a company that wanted all these design students who were very innovative, and they sold it for $650. So,
did they know what the market price would be?
I'm not quite sure how the negotiations went, but it was they walked in and walked away with it. There were 14 teams, each one more creative than the next. There were others, one that I didn't mention here, but they designed a T-shirt for the class. And in advance, they designed a T-shirt for this class, and since everyone was having a great time, everybody wanted the T-shirt, they sold them for $15 a piece to the people in the class. So they used the class as their own customers, which was great. And then they delivered them the day of. They took advance orders, went to Zazzle, got all the T-shirts, and everyone walked away with a T-shirt. So anyway, what do you think? This was a way for them to learn a tremendous number of things. Really, they again learned that opportunities are everywhere. This was not just the wallet in your pocket. They could walk across campus, and anywhere they looked, whether it was a restaurant, whether it was bicycles, whether it was Vini's ball, whether it was their pitch time in class, that there was value everywhere. It's like gold sitting waiting to be picked up. They also learned how to understand the assets they had. That sometimes the assets of the $5 they were focusing, the teams have focused on that. The ones that did the classic lemonade stand, and I have to tell you, the business school students in the class who did a car wash were not very successful. Okay? The ones who thought about all the assets they had were amazing. In fact, let me tell you a funny story. I did this project. The next quarter, I was teaching a different class. I teach a course on creativity and innovation. This was done in the D School, in the Design Institute. And I said, I want to do something similar, but I certainly can't use the same project because, you know, word gets around and people will do some similar things. So I said, how am I going to make this more general? So I told some folks about this earlier today. Do you guys know the story about the red paperclip guy? You know, how many of you have heard about the red paper? The guy who basically started out with one red paperclip, and he said, I have one red paperclip, and I really, really need a house. How am I going to go from a red paperclip to a house? You think you can go to his website. It's oneredpaperclip.com. And he set up a blog, and he said, this is my goal. Who wants to trade me for my paperclip? I'm going to take the best thing anyone will give me for my paperclip. So someone gave him a pen. So he said, okay, I'll take the pen. Now he said, okay, now I've got a pen. How am I going to leverage this pen? And so someone said, well, I'll give you a doorknob. So then he said, okay, now I've got a doorknob. And he kept going, and it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and he ended up with a house. I mean, it's really amazing. By the time I checked in, it was like, you know, he was some rock star's guitar or something. You know, it just kept getting bigger and bigger, and the more attention he got, the more people went to the site and were giving more and more interesting bids for the things, and the value kept going up. So I decided to take a twist on that, and I gave all the students in my class 10 paperclips and 4 hours. I thought I was being very generous. And I said, you need to create as much value as possible. Value measured in any way you want, not necessarily money. You can measure it in social value, you can measure it in money, you can measure it in creativity, whatever you want to measure it. So it is amazing the things students did with these paper. I had no idea what they, I mean, literally, I had no clue. In fact, halfway through the week, I thought, this is going to be a failure. I have no idea what's going to happen. This was a huge risk for me. I was going to put this on my failure resume. And it was unbelievable. Well, I'll tell you just a few things people did. One group decided that the new currency of the world was paperclips. And their goal was to generate as many paperclips as possible. And so they went out and found out that the Guinness Book World Record paperclip chain was something like, you know, 17 miles long. I can't, that's not right, but it's something in that order of magnitude. And they told everyone they knew, all of put it on Facebook, they were going to break the record. And everyone started giving them their paperclips. And they started with the chain, but they didn't finish the chain. And they ended up, though, bringing in a mountain of paperclips the size of Nebraska. Okay. Another group decided to create educational value. What did they do? They took their 10 paperclips, they traded a few of them for some paper, so they really took it very literally, traded for some paper, and they used the other paper clips to attach these pieces of paper. They created clues around campus for a scavenger hunt, sort of a treasure hunt of facts about Stanford history. And so they created this amazing treasure hunt across the whole university that they ended up giving to the Alumni Center, because they basically thought this would be a really fun project for anyone visiting campus to go on this special treasure hunt around campus. My favorite group, though, okay, I wish I had the video to show you because it's too funny. You know what? If you ask me nicely, I'll send you the video. They basically, I wish I had it. I'll check and see if it's on my computer. I'll show you later. They started out the bad boys theme. Okay, you know, bad boys, what you're going to do when they come for you. You know, okay, it starts out and you see them unwrapping the paperclip and picking the locks in the dorm, and you see the door open, and the, you know, the hand goes in the door, and the light comes out from the dorm room, and then it freeze frames, and then it says, the loot, and you see it scans. It starts out with paper clips, and then it goes to dollars, and then it goes to iPods, and then it goes to computers. This is, you know, total loot, you know, $83,464, and then, you know, any questions? I basically thought, I'm going to get fired right now. Okay, game over, it's done. Then it said, just kidding. So what they really did was equally clever and much more legal, is they made up a sign and they went to the Stanford Shopping Center. The sign said, Stanford students for sale, buy one, get two free. Okay, and what they did is they essentially entertained offers from people who came up to them saying, well, what do? They started out taking out recycling from stores. Then they started carrying people's bags, whatever people needed them to do. Then one woman came up and said, well, gee, you guys are in a creativity class. Would you be able to help me with a brainstorming exercise? I basically need to come up with some business ideas for a client. I'm a consultant. They said, no problem. So they went to her office. They ran a two-hour brainstorming with her, and she paid them in three computer monitors that she didn't need. So they came to class with three computer monitors. Anyway, end of that story. I didn't plan on taking so long. But the fact is, value doesn't necessarily have to do with money. It has to do with creating value in any certain way. So they also were iterating along the way, essentially like the team with the at the bike pumps, when they realized that along the way they could change their business model. And they also built a great team and create a lot of value. So I have one more story to tell. You want one more story?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, this is a project, I like failure, failure's good, where what I wanted to come up with, I wanted to design a game that captured the essence of entrepreneurship. And I was talking with a colleague of mine from Chile who started telling me something that he was doing with puzzles. And I said, that is it. So I created a game, here's how it works, and I'm going to show you a 5-minute video that takes, again, this 2-hour class down into 5 minutes, and you'll see exactly what happens. Here's what I do. I painted and built a dozen puzzles. So I took these 100-piece puzzles, and I spray-painted them and wrote different things on them. So each one's a different color. So one's red, blue, green, you'll see in a minute. And I take all the puzzles and put them in the front of the classroom. Everyone gets to take a quick look at them. Then I take them all and put them in one big bag and shake them all up. Okay? I know, doesn't that sound like fun? That's like the best part. And the students start getting worried at that point. And then what I do is I take the puzzle piece. Actually, to be fair, what I do is I cut the class into two halves. Each one is a different ecosystem. So there are six teams and four puzzles on one side of the room, and six teams and four puzzles on the other side of the room. So you realize there are six teams, four puzzles. Six teams, four puzzles. All right? The puzzles on each side of the room get put in a separate bag, shaken up, and then all the six teams come and take a handful of pieces. Okay? Their goal is to put together a puzzle. They are given a stack of poker chips, which is their currency that they can use. Here's how the points are measured. At the end of 1 hour, they take the largest piece of the puzzle they have, and they count up the number of pieces in it, and that's the number of points they have. For any small islands of pieces that they've put together, they count those up, and they divide by two. So they get half credit for small islands. And then they add in any money they have. Okay, that's it. Very simple. All right? Watch what happens. We'll talk about it afterwards. Okay? And you realize there are two ecosystems, so this is going on in two places. Okay, why don't you come up and take a quick look at the puzzles, and each team take back one stack of poker chips, because that's your starting cash. Okay, go on back to your tables, just so you can see what they say, these three puzzles. Okay. There you go. You got it.
So there's going to be more.
Oh, there's going to be more.
Yeah, there's going to be more pieces.
Big trouble.
Yeah.
And there's 100 pieces. That would be 300 if all were completely this.
In action.
They're all in one big island. We should discuss the strategy with all the other teams.
Okay, Leticia, I know you. We've known each other for a while.
Let's just do the power.
We'll give you less power for that.
Okay, you want to try your thing for my thing.
Okay. No. The whole thing or nothing. Come on, okay. Make it simple. You don't want
to
do business.
I've got these guys batting down the door to do a deal.
You don't
want to
do business.
So are we going to swap?
We could swap your green for our blue.
Even exchange?
The market has changed. Uh-oh. You're not going to believe it. A law has been passed that everyone in the world has to use your technology.
This is like a really cool thing. Every team gets 5 more puzzle pieces.
If we all collectively come out on top, we're going to come out on top of them too. Our team is definitely in on it, right? Full collaboration.
I have some marketing data. So if anybody would like to buy pictures of the puzzles,
whatever the art is, it's going to be cheaper if we all just, hey guys, pay the minimum price, whatever it is, right?
I'm running an auction for the rest of the chips.
One chip.
Two chips.
Three chips.
Anybody want to
split the bag?
20 chips.
20 chips.
Take it.
Okay, there you go.
That's why I'm...
Oh, we want to know that you can deliver on your commitment.
This edge right here. There's an edge.
This is something else.
Bulb of an edge in there.
Oh, now... What is, you just traded all the... We will trade this for all the chips, the pieces.
We want your pieces.
With these purple?
This color. We want this color. Okay. This color.
This is the investor, yes.
Oh, investor is uppercase.
This one's valuable. We might trade for this one. Okay. Can you negotiate with her while we're doing the puzzle?
It's got two parallel lines.
All of this for all of that, plain and simple, nothing more. No. Forget it. It's all of this for all of this. Plain and simple.
That's not ours. Okay.
I miss these guys.
No, this one right here. Yes.
That goes to the dark blue team. There. Perfect.
All right. Okay, good.
Seven.
What happened here?
We just figured that if we could all four teams accomplish the full task together, we'd have a much better chance of coming out better.
I needed to have trust. Like, I didn't build trust. I know they're in my universe, but I still didn't trust them.
The negotiations started. People started trading. So we didn't have any control over the situation. And the competition started, and the way you could sell that.
So once you started competing with each other, it became very difficult to unwind that.
Yeah.
And people sort of built up their barriers.
Overestimated our ability to put a puzzle together, even if we have all the pieces.
Having all the pieces is necessary, but not sufficient, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you needed to have all the pieces, but you also needed to have the right team together.
Yeah, we would have sold our surfaces. They don't have money, but they had chips. Puzzle pieces. They don't have money, but they have puzzle pieces. And so right now we have enough chips to be, and we have puzzle pieces. So we kind of prevent one team, but still get our stuff done. So it's a big kind of, okay, let's be on top.
We ended up like just saying, well, look, we'll make the agreement now that if something happens, we'll just split it evenly and keep going with whatever we have.
And when they put it in a different context, and then we're going to against a bigger, the better, it's better for me, because it's like I have more manpower. We're going up against something bigger. So it's all about the
context.
It's framing. It's just
framing. So. Isn't that a good point? And the thing is, you control the framing of the problem, right? It wasn't something that I framed. You controlled the framing.
We should have subdivided the tasks according to our competencies. Like, I was doing a lot of bartering and trading, and I'm not good at that, and I'm much better at making puzzles. And it was only towards the end when we decided, okay, we're done, and then I was helping do the puzzles, and I was just thinking that probably happened to a lot of teams, mm-hmm. that they were doing the puzzle making and the bartering at the same time, and if we had broken up that two people are going to do the puzzles, one person's going to fend off everyone else, and one person's going to barter, or things like that.
That a division of labor would be helpful, and playing to people's strength.
We were so engrossed with this team that came to us and said, let's do some trading and so forth, that we completely forgot about this team. And they actually had more to offer us, and we had more to offer them. And we could have created a lot of value together, but we didn't realize it because it was out of our...
Interesting. So, what did they learn here in this 2 hours? What kind of things came up? What's that? A lot of things they could have done instead. So, yeah? Anything specific that you saw them thinking about during this time that they got to experience in this very short exercise?
They had to work with each other, but they had to do it in a way that wasn't fighting.
Right, how to collaborate even with their competitors. They had sort of, and what happened is, the reason I like doing this in big groups where you divide it into two two ecosystems is by definition what happens is different in each. So one side of the room is collaborating with each other. They put their pieces together and they figured out how to work together. And in fact, I don't know if you noticed, the student said, I realized once we reframed it that we were competing with the other side of the room instead of competing against each other, all of a sudden they had a very different approach. Whereas the other teams, when they start competing and holding back pieces, they spend so much time competing with each other that they're much less successful. So that was an interesting lesson. Other things that came out of this? Yeah.
They have learned nothing because they won't see this problem again. So this problem, like a lot of problems in life, is that you always get a new problem.
Really good point.
So.
So one of the interesting, I think you're making a really good point, is if you say, well, gee, I'm not making puzzles again. But I think if you create enough opportunities, like the $5 project, like the puzzle project, like the wallet project, the lessons get reinforced. In fact, here are the list of things that I think that they get out of this. Teamwork, trust, collaboration. These are certainly things they had to do in the other projects as well. Leveraging limited resources. They didn't have very much, but they had to figure out what they had to barter. Negotiation. Strategy. You know, one of the interesting things is how much time did they spend strategizing versus doing? And in fact, that's a really interesting thing that they realized. Some of the teams dove right in doing stuff before actually figuring out what they were going to do, and their head was spinning, and they didn't take the time to actually figure out, hey, how are we actually going to approach this? Understanding the market conditions and the fact that market conditions are changing. They were, you know, every 10 minutes I would do so. They knew that this was going to happen, but every 10 minutes something would happen. And I had a list of about 10 different things that would happen. And that, for example, you lose a key person on your team who goes to a competitor. One person on every team has to leave and go to another team and take three puzzle pieces. So the fact is, there were lots of things that shook things up, which is very similar to what would happen in the real world. In addition, they had to figure out a division of labor. Those teams that did not do that well really suffered, because they really needed some people who were dealing with strategy and other people were actually implementing. In fact, as they said, some of them realized that once they had the pieces, that was necessary but not sufficient to actually be successful. And of course, they had to be very creative. And one of the things I like about this is the metaphor is that when you start a new venture, the pieces are all there. You just don't control them all. And how do you get the pieces under your control? And so the puzzle pieces are a perfect metaphor for that. Yeah. Yeah.
And so a lot of times people have life experiences, but without the debrief, there's not the learning. And by the collection of learnings around the room, they gain insight, which they would not have gotten on their own. So there's a collective debrief to this process, which I think lets people conceptually see what's going on.
I always build in debrief time. And so that's why I never like to have classes that are under 2 hours. There's sort of a half hour to get set up and get things ready, at least an hour to work on a project, and at least a half an hour of debriefing time. I mean, you only heard, 2 minutes of the debrief, but a whole half hour at least to talk about it. And then usually there's some sort of assignment afterwards to even do further reflections on what happened and relate it to other things.
I think the thing that one would learn,
yeah.
Not that you have a plan, it's that it will change, and you have to be very aware of how it's changing and what you're going to do about it.
Exactly. And in fact, being flexible is incredibly important. I don't know if you remember, one of the students said, hey, listen, let's just make this decision. Who knows what's going to happen? We're going to just have to go with the flow. Because they didn't know what new things I was going to throw at them that might unravel the decisions they're making. But they said, we've got to put a stake in the ground, but be flexible, knowing that when new things come, we're going to be willing to change. So really good point. So anyway, I love this project, and I've done it several times now, and it always is different. Oh, one of my favorite times I did this over at the medical school with these biodesign students. And here's what happened. It was something unbelievable. It's a 12 fellows in a very special program. And so it was a very small group. I had four teams of three people, and I had three puzzles. So it was a very, very small version of this. After about 5 minutes, one of the students on one of the teams said, hey, if we just put all of our pieces together and build these puzzles, I mean, it was only three puzzles, and there were 12 people. They could have built it, If we just put all the pieces together and build the puzzles, we'll just make the puzzles. And I kind of got nervous thinking the whole thing was going to fail, because if they did that, it just would have been a puzzle building exercise as opposed to looking at all these other things. And he said it several times. And everyone finally said, nah, I don't want to do that. So the fact is, they wanted the competitive environment, even though they had been given the answer, that really the solution was working together to make this happen. And they would have come away with much more value had they done that, which was suggested to them. Is that interesting? But they essentially discounted that and decided that that wasn't going to be their strategy. So. The business school students completely, I have to tell you, did a really bad job, because you know what they did? No, I'll tell you what they did. They were trying to outsmart the system. They decided to withhold a lot of pieces, thinking that if I have simple pieces of other teams, if I have pieces, those are going to increase in value until the end. So they decided that they were going to basically have these, what are they called? What's it called? The keystones. You know, I'm going to have the keystones for the arches that's going to be the final thing they need to finish. But what happened is most of the teams didn't get close to finishing their puzzle. So those extra pieces had zero value, because there was a bonus for finishing the whole thing. If you finish the whole puzzle, then it was a 25-point bonus if you finished the whole thing. But if you didn't finish, there was no bonus. So if they waited to the end and people weren't finished, there was zero value, but there was no market. So they miscalculated very clearly and did not even end up on the chart in terms of their returns. So anyway, you can kind of outsmart the system, or try to. So essentially, I hope that you agree with me that entrepreneurship is a contact sport, and you got to get in the game. You got to get in there, you got to do stuff, and we do this in lots of different ways. I mean, these are experiential exercises. Also use a lot of case studies. I'm sure you do in class. It's a way for, you read a story and you got to get immersed. You now are the CEO or the head of marketing, and you've got to make these decisions and sort of role playing. But there's so many other ways in which you can get into the game. And I'm just a really strong believer that these type of experiences are really how we learn and incorporate these experiences. So I'm going to leave you with my favorite video clip, which anyone who knows me has seen this video clip before. Can you guess, Gary, which one it is? No? Okay, it's my favorite. This is, we have a website called The Educator's Corner, which has thousands of video clips and podcasts from our classes. In fact, those two videos I showed of my class are on The Educator's Corner. So if you put in puzzle or wallet, you can get those. They're free. You can download them, you can stream them, and watch them again if you're curious. Show all your friends. So this is one, my favorite, from Vinod Khosla. Does anyone know who Vinod Khosla is? Yeah, who is he? He's a venture capitalist at Kleiner Perkins. He also was the founder of Sun Microsystems. So he's a really smart guy. He's really, really into green technology now. And this is a 27-second clip. In fact, if you're really nice, I'll even play it for you twice.
One thing I would say is find a big problem. To me, any big problem is a big opportunity. Because if you think about it, no problem, no solution. No company. It's very simple. Every big problem is a big opportunity. If you don't have a big problem, you don't have a big opportunity. No. Nobody will pay you to solve a non-problem.
Do you want to hear it again? Okay. Anyway, you can listen to this if you go to the Educator's Corner and put in Vinod Khosla. You will find that. You can play it as many times as you want. And so let me ask you before I stop. How many of you think, now there's no right answer here, how many of you think that entrepreneurship can be taught? Now. Did anybody change their mind? Anybody? Nobody changed their mind? Okay. Well, if you change your mind, you let me know, because I'm curious. This is, one of the things when I had to phrase this, we are, I believe, teaching students not to be entrepreneurs, but to be entrepreneurial. This is a state of mind. It's not about starting a company. If you view entrepreneurship as just about starting companies, you're getting the tip of the iceberg. When you look at a company like Google or Apple or any other company, do you think the founders are the only entrepreneurs? I certainly hope not. And it's one of the reasons why there's a big sucking sound from our program to companies like Google, because they want people who are entrepreneurial. And so the fact is, we're not teaching people just to be founders. We're teaching them to be innovative, opportunity seekers, those people who are looking at ways to create value in every situation. Yeah?
But I think that's the key, is that you're teaching, that you can teach people to be entrepreneurs, but not necessarily entrepreneurs.
But not necessarily entrepreneurs, because I think that that's something, either you have it or you don't, and you can acquire, you can be taught skills that can help you hone in on that. That's my
right.
Opinion.
So the point is, not everybody is a founder, but many people can become much more entrepreneurial. In fact, one of the things I do, I'll tell you one quick little story. We run a program called the Mayfield Fellows Program, which is a 9-month intensive work study program. And at the very end of the 9 months, students, it's like getting into graduate school to get into this. There are essays and letters of recommendation, interviews, et cetera, et cetera. At the end of the 9 months, I send all the students back their original essay. And I say, okay, read this. You wrote this a year ago. Now I want you to read it and tell me how your attitudes about entrepreneurship and about life and about your career have changed. And they have to write another essay, a reflections essay. And the most wonderful thing about this is that everybody gets something different out of it. There's no one response to this experience. And so what I realize is that we are successful even if people come out at the end of the program that say, I realize I don't have the risk profile to be an entrepreneur. I really want to be in this ecosystem, but I think I want to be a patent lawyer. Or I really want to be in the marketing department or lead the engineering team. I don't want to be a founder. So the fact is, there are many, many roles within a venture besides being the founder. And through experiences like the ones I'm telling you about, students end up coming out realizing how they can fit if they're interested into this ecosystem. So thank you very much. We'll be right back.